Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 462, titled Fifth Column, Part 3, The Subversion of Operation Green Quest. This program is being recorded on May 30th of 2004. WFMU archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent shows streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows for download only also on Real Audio at a longer address linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery address and to the Real Audio equipped For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire stocks all of the programs and lectures I've done over the years. I do not get money from that arrangement, incidentally. And in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record program number 462 within a week or so of the airing of this program. By the way, there is a page, there's a place to click on at the beginning of each For the Record description for listeners who would like to support the work that I'm doing. Just click on the page that enables you to support the work that I'm doing, and the rest should be self-explanatory. Note that there is a search engine now on the Spitfire website to help listeners locate various subjects. Also be aware that the landmark text Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning is available for download on the Spitfire website for free. Okay? Alrighty. Now, we've been looking at Operation Green Quest. We've been taking a look at the subversion of the investigation into Al-Qaeda funding sources, and we've been taking a look at the pivotal role of powerful political connections between people within the Bush administration, people within the Republican Party, people within the fossil fuels industry in the U.S., and their business and ideological allies in the Saudi power elite as well. Some of the latter have been involved in helping to finance Al-Qaeda. I have described the interdiction of Operation Green Quest as part of what is at one level a civil war within the intelligence and law enforcement establishments that in turn is part of a larger struggle, literally a continuation of World War II, in which the Underground Reich and its Islamist cadre are attacking the U.S. from the outside at the same time as a fifth column is subverting it from within. This is very much what happened to France in the run-up to World War II. It's why the French capitulated so quickly. Also, I want to stress that one of the things we're going to be looking at in this program concerns not only further inquiries into the PTEC situation, but note with regard to the curious performance of air defense units on September 11th, note that PTEC, a company we're going to talk more about, was developing software not only for the Air Force, but also for the Federal Aviation Administration as well. More about this civil war. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the National Review of May 27th of 2003. Some conservative elements have actually been doing a better job of covering the subversion of Operation Green Quest than many of the so-called progressive media voices. This article is titled Perilous Power Play, FBI versus Homeland Security. It's co-authored by Rita Katz and Josh Devon. Rita Katz, under the pseudonym of Anonymous, wrote a book called Terrorist Hunter that we're going to access again a little later. Rita Katz did much of the groundwork for Operation Green Quest. This article reads, "A war has broken out on American soil, largely below the public radar screen." On May 13, 2003, Attorney General John Ashcroft and Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge signed a, quote, memorandum of agreement, unquote, between the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security that gives the Federal Bureau of Investigation unprecedented unilateral control of all terrorist financing investigations and operations. The agreement raises questions about the need for a Department of Homeland Security if the FBI will be handling all relevant terror investigations. Several seasoned government agents fear for the nation's security should the FBI be tackling the most terrorism cases, as their ineptitude in preventing terrorism has been established time and time again. Yet the memorandum between Ashcroft and Ridge places the FBI in an incredibly powerful position over Homeland Security. According to the memorandum, quote, all appropriate DHS leads relating to money laundering and financial crimes will be checked with the FBI, unquote. If the FBI feels the case is related to terrorist financing and should belong to them, quote, the investigation and operation of the matter shall be led by the FBI, unquote. This usurpation creates a gigantic imbalance of power in criminal investigations, as the FBI now has the power to create or kill any terrorist financing investigation it deems appropriate or inappropriate to investigate. Reviewing, by the way, an item that we looked at in Side 1, we reviewed the fact that FBI Chief Robert Mueller was in charge of the BCCI investigation. That investigation was badly attenuated. Had it been pursued as vigorously as it might have, it not only would have resulted in the indictment of the elder George Bush for Iran-Contra and Iraqgate-related crimes, but it also would have led in the direction of the younger George Bush's connections to the BCCI milieu through people like Salem bin Laden and Khalid bin Mahfouz, both of them, obviously the Salem bin Laden, a member of the bin Laden family, Khalid bin Mahfouz, alleged by many sources to have been involved in terror financing. And bear in mind that, as noted in For the Record 310 and 424, among other programs, Robert Mueller's appointment to head the FBI in the summer of 2001 in many ways heralded the fact that the BCCI milieu would not be pursued in any further investigations. And so far, the FBI has worked in the direction of interdicting terror financing investigations. Those investigations, were they pursued in the way they could be pursued, would lead not only to the Bush administration, the fossil fuels industry, and the Republican Party, as well as their counterparts in Saudi Arabia, but it would lead to the disclosure of connections between the links of disclosures of the links between the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids and this administration and Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Al-Taqwa, and in the background, the underground Reich. Continuing. Returning once again to this National Review article, this puts the FBI in a position to control too much and is eerily reminiscent of the former Soviet Union's oppressive intelligence agency, the KGB. Like the KGB, the FBI seeks to run itself with no checks and balances, a necessary hallmark of the American system of government and civil rights. The memorandum makes the point that FBI agents assigned to work in conjunction with DHS agents, quote, are provided full and timely access to all data developed in ICE's, Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, money laundering, and financial crimes cases on an ongoing basis, unquote. The reciprocal is not stated in the agreement, continuing the FBI's long-held policy of refusing to share information with other agencies. Amazingly, though, just after 9/11, the FBI admitted it did not have the ability to handle counterterrorism cases. According to a May 2003 General Accounting Office report about interagency information sharing, quote, the director of the FBI testified in June of 2002 that implementing a more proactive approach to preventing terrorist acts and denying terrorist groups the ability to operate and raise funds require a centralized and robust analytical capability that did not exist in the FBI's counterterrorism division, unquote. Yet, because the FBI is so well-funded and staffed compared to the other agencies, the Bureau can play the PR game better than any other agency. Thus, while strong-arming other agencies and bullying them out of investigations, the FBI maintains a positive face in the eyes of the American public and takes credit for investigations in which they were only tangentially involved. For those who do not fear the FBI will be handling future terrorist financing investigations, let's look at the agency's track record when it comes to protecting the United States from terrorist financing. Now, the next case is the PTEC case about which we spoke in Side 1. This is significant from several different standpoints. First of all, the fact that this software company held sensitive contracts not only with the FBI but with the U.S. Air Force, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Department of Defense, also with the White House, raises some very interesting questions about the events of September 11th. We're going to talk about that. Note also the fact that one of the prime financial backers of PTEC is Yassin Al-Qadi, implicated in terrorist financing, someone we spoke about in 461. And note in particular the name of Yaqub Mirza, a member of the board of directors of PTEC. It was Yaqub Mirza who set up the firms that were targeted by the Operation Green Quest raids of March of 2002, yet Mirza was never indicted. Among the elements that were implicated in those raids of 3/20/2002 are elements associated with Grover Norquist and Karl Rove's Islamic Institute. That in turn overlaps not only the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, but also the Bush administration per se. Of the PTEC investigation, we read, "Even after the September 11th attacks, the FBI failed to pursue obvious terrorist financing leads. In a hugely embarrassing moment, the FBI failed to do anything about PTEC Incorporated, a company whose prime investor was a specially designated global terrorist entity, Saudi Yassin al-Qaeda. In desperation, the vice president of sales at PTEC contacted the FBI and pleaded with them to look into the organization, as he saw in the news that Qaeda was allegedly connected to funding al-Qaeda. After repeated meetings with increasingly higher-ranking FBI officials where the employees beseeched the agency to look into the company, the Bureau did nothing, despite knowing that Qaeda was a primary financier of PTEC." Note the following. "Furthermore, the FBI was aware that PTEC provided computer software for several government agencies, including the FBI itself, the Federal Aviation Administration, the U.S. Treasury, the Department of Defense, the IRS, and the White House, proving a visible and viable threat to national security." By the way, on side one of the program, we noted that specifically PTEC held contracts with the U.S. Air Force itself. Continuing, "The FBI ignored the repeated requests of concerned employees. Frighteningly, when an employee told the president of PTEC he felt he had to contact the FBI regarding Qaeda's involvement in the company, the president allegedly told him not to worry because Yaqub Mirza, who was on the board of directors of the company and was himself a target of a terrorist financing raid in March of 2002, had contacts high within the FBI. After months of the FBI refusing to do anything substantive, it took efforts of U.S. Customs, now a part of Homeland Security, to raid the business in December of 2002 and jumpstart the investigation into the alleged terrorist financial network." Recall that one of the things that we looked at in For the Record 460, interrupting briefly, was the fact that according to the interrogation of Abu Zubaida, a key al-Qaeda operative captured in Afghanistan in March of 2002, one of the people who was in the employ of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda was the chief of, basically the head of the Pakistani Air Force. When one considers that allegation, the fact that according to the interrogation of Abu Zubaida, the head of the Pakistani Air Force was involved with al-Qaeda, with the fact that a software company financed in part by an alleged al-Qaeda financier was developing software for, among other institutions, the FAA, the Air Force, the FBI, and the White House, it raises some very, very interesting questions about the performance of air defense units and the FAA itself on September 11th. And again, the title of this column, of this program, Fifth Column, because it's one of the things that we have going here. More about the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002. "Perhaps the FBI's biggest blunder was in ignoring the enormous alleged terrorist financial network of companies and nonprofit organizations, mostly in Herndon, Virginia, named by investigators as the SAR Network. The FBI had been aware of the SAR network since the early 1990s when the Bureau investigated alleged terrorist Sami al-Arian, as the investigation revealed that the SAR network was funneling money to al-Arian. The FBI chose to ignore the case for unknown reasons, though some have speculated it was due to the SAR network's close association to wealthy Saudis who funded the network. It was not until Operation Green Quest, a joint task force headed by U.S. Customs, which sought to disrupt terrorist financing, picked up the scent of the SAR network, that a raid even occurred. In March 2002, Green Quest, in a victory for Americans everywhere, raided the SAR network in 15 locations in the largest terrorist financial bust in U.S. history." Skipping down, Now, the FBI is attempting to wrest the SAR network investigation from GreenQuest and take all the credit for GreenQuest's dedication and hard work. The agreement between Ashcroft and Ridge is a crushing blow to GreenQuest, as it effectively dissolves the outstanding task force. According to the memorandum, quote, "The Secretary of Homeland Security agrees that no later than June 30, 2003, Operation GreenQuest will no longer exist as a program name." GreenQuest, the most successful anti-terrorist financing task squad in the history of the United States, is being disbanded because of the FBI's lust for power and glory. At a time when Al-Qaeda is resurging, the more agencies we have sharing information and investigating terrorism, the better off this nation will be. Given the FBI's track record, the Bureau should be punished, not rewarded, for unjustifiably bullying a new department into giving it more power, especially after FBI Director Robert Mueller admitted the Bureau does not have the analytical capability to provide effective counterterrorism. And I would suggest that Mueller, who was less than vigorous in his pursuit of operation of the BCCI investigation, was basically appointed for political reasons, because he could be counted upon to interdict the investigations into the terrorist financing conduits, because those would ultimately overlap the structural economic relationships between the GOP, the Bush administration, and the Saudi power elite, many of whom are implicated in the financing of terrorism. Now, note that one of the directors of PTEC, the Yassin al-Qaeda financed company that we were just talking about, was Yaqub Mirza, who set up the various fronts in the SAR network. We're going to review now a short section from an article called Charity Cases. This is authored by Dave Armstrong. It's called, the article specifically, Charity Cases: Why Has the Bush Administration Failed to Stop Saudi Funding of Terrorism? It's by David Armstrong from the March 2004 issue of Harper's Magazine. We've talked about this in past broadcasts. Of Yaqub Mirza and his sacrosanct status. And the connections do not end there. One of the Muslim activists who met with O'Neill, that's former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, was Talat Otman, a longtime friend and former business associate of President Bush. The two served together on the board of the Texas-based oil company Harkin Energy starting in the late 1980s and have remained close ever since. Otman sat on Harkin's board as the representative of Abdullah Taha Baksh, a Saudi business magnate, and a close associate of suspected terrorist financier Khalid bin Mahfouz. Baksh now heads an oil company that is a subsidiary of Halliburton, the energy giant formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. In addition to his work at the Islamic Institute, again that headed up by Grover Norquist and greatly aided by Karl Rove, Otman serves on the board of Amana Mutual Funds Trust, an Islamic investment group that had close ties to raided entities and yet was not itself targeted. At the time of the GreenQuest raids in March of 2002, at least four figures from the targeted groups were affiliated with Amana, including M. Yaqub Mirza, the individual who set up the U.S. branch of the Muslim World League, the fundraising arm of the U.S. branch of IIRO, and many of the other raided organizations. Despite Mirza's presence on the board, and despite the fact that large sums of money from the suspect groups have moved through Amana, GreenQuest agents chose not to raid the firm. But somebody who did receive heat from the authorities were the people who had originally broken the Operation GreenQuest raids, including Rita Katz, the author of the co-author of that National Review article that I just read. Reviewing from Terrorist Hunter by Rita Katz, "The CIA was investigating me and the SAR investigators from GreenQuest and Customs. The CIA and the FBI investigated everyone who had anything to do with the SAR investigation. White vans and SUVs with dark windows appeared near all the homes of the SAR investigators. All agents, some of whom were very experienced with surveillance, knew they were being followed. So was I. I felt that I was being followed everywhere and watched at home, in the supermarket, on the way to work, and for what? The customs agents were questioned. So were their supervisors. So was the U.S. attorney on the SAR case. One of the questions they were all asked was whether they'd leaked material to me. They all kept saying that this was the most preposterous idea. They all said that before I came, none of them had the slightest clue about SAR and 555. They said that there was nothing of value that they could give me that I didn't have already. That it was I who gave them the material, not the other way around. None of the investigated parties has the slightest clue as to the real reason they were being investigated, unquote. Risking criticism for being unfoundly paranoid, I must convey my theory about the investigation and the CIA's involvement in it. I don't know for certain what's the deal between the CIA investigating the SAR investigators, but it sure feels as if someone up in that agency doesn't like the idea that the Saudi Arabian boat is rocked. The raids on 555 Grove Street had already taken place. The CIA couldn't change that. But investigating and giving the people behind the raids a hard time is a most efficient way of making sure the SAR investigation stops there. Which, come to think of it, may be the reason the government looks so unfavorably on the lawsuit filed by 9/11 victims' families against several Saudi entities and individuals, accusing them of funding terrorism and seeking damages, unquote. And more now about this Wahhabi lobby fifth column, basically, in the United States. First of all, note that M. Yaqub Mirza was described by, in that passage we read, as having high contacts within the FBI. That's consistent with the charges that were voiced by Sybil Edmonds with regard to the reasons for her being muzzled, and also for the apparent interdiction of Operation Green Quest and the civil war which is currently taking place. We're going to turn now to the book House of Bush, House of Saud by Craig Unger, a newly released and very good book detailing the structural economic relationships between the Bush administration, the petroleum industry, and the Saudi power elite, and the latter have been involved in the financing of al-Qaeda. One of the things we're going to talk about here is the relationship between Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, and someone who's very, very close to both Georges Bush and former FBI Director Louis Freeh. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the establishment of a backdoor channel between Prince Bandar and Louis Freeh that helped to subvert the Clinton administration's investigation into Saudi financing of al-Qaeda. After the Khobar Towers bombing in 1996, Clinton's National Security Advisor Sandy Berger met with Prince Bandar to press for better Saudi cooperation with the FBI. But the Saudis still refused to allow the FBI access to the suspects or relevant materials and tried to blame Iran for the bombing. Berger got nowhere. According to Benjamin and Simon, Bandar's unending evasions were so frustrating that Berger described them as Groundhog Day rituals, a reference to the Bill Murray movie in which one day repeats itself endlessly. At the same time Prince Bandar was stalling Berger, however, he had secretly established a back channel to FBI Director Louis Freeh. A 1993 Clinton appointee, Freeh had never enjoyed a good relationship with the White House, partly because of the Bureau's disastrous failure in counterterrorism. According to Benjamin and Simon, Bandar eagerly exploited Freeh's well-known antipathy toward Clinton to, quote, undercut U.S. efforts to pursue the investigation, unquote. Notwithstanding Berger's repeated efforts to get Saudi help, Bandar told Freeh again and again that the White House had absolutely no interest in the investigation whatsoever. But President Clinton kept after the Saudis. When he met with Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah in 1998, Clinton warned Abdullah that Saudi-American relations would suffer if the Saudis did not cooperate on the Khobar Towers investigation. Nevertheless, Bandar continued to tell Freeh that he was the only one in Washington who cared about the Americans who had died in Khobar Towers. In response, Freeh did something highly irregular. He reached out to former President Bush, knowing full well how Bush was revered by the Saudis, and asked Bush to be his secret emissary to get the Saudis to cooperate with the investigation. Later, Bandar invited Freeh to his estate in Northern Virginia and told him the FBI would be allowed to watch through a one-way mirror while Saudis interrogated the subjects. According to Elsa Walsh of The New Yorker, Freeh credited this sudden breakthrough not to the Clinton administration's efforts, but to former President George H.W. Bush. Whether it was Bush's phone call or pressure from Clinton that actually triggered the Saudi cooperation is not entirely clear. But one thing was certain: the House of Saud preferred Bush, not Clinton, in part because the Democratic administration was violating the unwritten rule about Saudi-American relations. Don't ask any questions about what really goes on in Saudi Arabia. And then Craig Unger goes on to write about some of the BCCI links to the Saudi milieu that was funding al-Qaeda. And still later, Craig Unger briefly encapsulates the formation of the Islamic Institute and the links between the GOP and the Muslim milieu that was targeted in Operation Green Quest. By the way, there's good discussion in this book of how a great many of the Muslim elements that have risen to the fore in the American Muslim community are not in any way representative of worldwide Muslims, but rather are the sort of reactionaries from the Islamic world that the Bush administration, basically the counterparts to the Bush administration. They are altogether reactionary and not representative. Nevertheless, with Norquist working behind the scenes, Bush aggressively pursued the Islamists in hope of winning their endorsements. In appearances on TV, Bush and fellow campaign staffers referred not just to churches and synagogues as places of worship, but to mosques as well. And talking about the Sami al-Aryan relationship, but Aryan had unusual credentials for a Bush supporter. Since 1995, as the founder and chairman of the board of World and Islam Enterprise, or WISE, a Muslim think tank, al-Aryan had been under investigation by the FBI for his associations with Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian terrorist group. And this goes on to describe not only Sami al-Aryan, but the links between the Islamic Institute and the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids. However, ultimately, some of the key documentation was destroyed in some of the key documentation on the Sami al-Aryan case was destroyed. In December of 2003, clerks at a federal courthouse in Tampa accidentally destroyed search warrants in the al-Aryan case. The documents contained affidavits from federal agents that supported 1995 searches of al-Aryan's home and offices and were among thousands of documents shredded sometime between 1998 and 2002. As this book went to press, there were serious questions as to whether the destruction of the documents might affect his prosecution. And again, talking more about the GOP Islamist links. When the convention ended on August 3rd, after George W. Bush had formally been nominated for president, between his family's extended personal and financial ties to the House of Saud and his campaign's ties to Islamists, it could be said that he was truly the Arabian candidate. And there will be more documentation presented on this connection in the description for the Record program number 462. This, however, concludes Side 2 of For the Record 462, Fifth Column, Part 3, The Subversion of Operation Green Quest. This is being recorded on May 30th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.